chapter 17, 1 through 6 tonight. Let me go ahead and read those verses. And one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I shall show you the judgment of the great harlot, who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality. And upon her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered greatly." Well, as we've seen as we've gone through Revelation and the visions that John has been given, and that is behind everything that is going on in the world, there are spiritual forces behind them. There's the spirit of this world under the dominion of the ruler of this world, and then there's the kingdom of Christ, which is not of this world. In fact, it's the exact opposite of this world. This world is hostile to and opposed to all to the kingdom of Christ, because the kingdom of Christ is opposed to all that the world stands for, all the principles and the beliefs which govern the world's thinking and their practices, that drives them and motivates them. Now, in Christianity seeks to gain influence in the world, whether it's political, whether it's economic, whether it's social, and we're seeing this today, it only succeeds in sinking the spirit of true Christianity into the spirit of the world, and they become indistinguishable. When the purpose of Christ's coming was not to transform the culture, it wasn't to reform society, but it was to transform the human heart, to give a new birth. It was to destroy the works of the devil, to destroy the kingdom of this world, and to set up His kingdom in the hearts and minds of believers, to transfer them from the domain of darkness to the kingdom of His beloved Son. And these two domains, these two kingdoms, could not be more unlike, more opposite. After all, what's more opposite of light than dark? What's more opposite of evil than good? What's more opposite from a lie than the truth? And so, if the principles that govern these two kingdoms and the rulers that govern these two kingdoms are so vastly different, should there not be a great distinction between the citizens of these two kingdoms? Should there not be a great deal of difference in the principles and the values and the ways of thinking between the citizens of these two kingdoms? Should the principles from which they operate and they live and they think and they reason and what they set their mind and affections on be totally different? See, there's a warfare between these two kingdoms. As Paul states in Ephesians 6:12, our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. These two kingdoms are completely incompatible. There's no way to harmonize them. There's no way one can accommodate the other. There's a perpetual warfare. There can be no peace between them. There cannot even be a truce. But this war is coming to an end, and the victor is never in doubt. And that's what we see here in chapter 17, introduced at the end of 16. Remember, at the end of chapter 16, we were told of the seventh bowl, the pouring out of the seventh bowl. And this completes the wrath of God, as verse 17 of chapter 16 states, "It is done." And this pouring out of the bowl was accompanied by a great earthquake. There's a brief mention here of Babylon the Great, how she was remembered and been given the fierce cup, or the cup of the fierce wrath of God. Well, as we come to chapter 17 and 18, there's a chapter 17 and 18 are a continuation, an expansion of what is involved in this cup of wrath for Babylon the Great. What is the extent of its judgment? The extent of its religious, political, and economic influence of this great harlot, this Babylon the Great. And what leads to the collapse of this satanic Babylonian system? After all, Babylon's doom was predicted over in chapter 14, verse 8. And another angel, a second one, followed, saying, fallen is Babylon the Great. She was made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion or immorality. And again, this is an allusion to Isaiah chapter 21, verse 9, which is a prophecy of the fall of Babylon. Here, Babylon is depicted as a great harlot, an exceedingly immoral woman. Now, this is a direct contrast, and the contrast is deliberate. There's a direct contrast between the harlot, her nature, her character, her dominion, versus with that of the New Jerusalem, the Bride of Christ, over in Revelation 21:9. And one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I shall show you the Bride, the wife of the Lamb." Two totally complete different women. Now, chapter 17 focuses on the religious aspects of the Babylonian system. And chapter 17 can be divided into three parts. First, there's the description and the revealing of the harlot and the beast. This is in verses 1 through 6. Then in verses 7 through 14, there's the significance of the symbolism. It's explained concerning the beast and the woman. And then there's the judgment of the harlot in verses 15 through 18. Now, there's two dominant figures in chapter 17. There's the harlot, the great harlot, and there's the beast. And John is an eyewitness. He's writing as an eyewitness to the judgment of the great harlot. He's shown by an angel, one of the angels that's connected with the bowl judgment, says verse 1 of chapter 17 makes plain, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls. So what bowl it had, we're not told, but it's one of the angels involved and connected with the bowl judgments. And the purpose for summoning John, where he's told, "Come here," the purpose is to show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. So he's being summoned with the purpose of being shown the judgment of the harlot. And again, the word there, judgment, is in the future tense. And there's a series of definite articles here in verse 1. It is the judgment of the harlot, the one sitting on many waters. So it's very particular, very definite. The word judgment here is referring to a judicial sentence and the carrying out of that sentence. Her title, the Great Harlot, matches her actions described over in chapter 14, verse 8. She has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality. She's an adulteress. She's a seducer. She's leads into false religion, false spirituality. And again, it's spiritual harlotry, forsaking the real for the counterfeit. This is something Israel was constantly doing, and what God was constantly confronting Israel with was their spiritual harlotry, their spiritual adultery, forsaking the real for the counterfeit, forsaking the fountain of living waters and making for themselves broken cisterns which cannot hold water. And so this, the harlot here is the epitome of false religion. There's only two systems in the world, God's and Satan's. And there's only one true, but there's many, many forms of the false, multitudes of forms of the false. But all of them are in opposition to the true. And all of these systems, and this is why she's called Babylon the Great, all of these systems have their roots in the attitude that produced the Tower of Babel. Let us make a name for ourselves. Genesis 11. This is the motivating force behind Babel. Pride, ambition, selfishness. All of these things are the very heart of all apostasies, all apostasy, all false religion, all forms of counterfeit Christianity. They're a work of a person's own invention. After all, that's why they love it. Why do people love the forms of godliness that are out there today? Why do people love all the entertainment-driven and false forms of worship out there today? All the extravaganzas? Because it's their own invention. They invented them. Of course they love them. They're a work of their own hands, and so they love them. And this is at the root of all false religion. This is why they love it. That's why they cling to it. It's because they invented it. So those who the world admires the most are those who are the most self-promotional. In fact, to advance in the estimation of the world and in the eyes of the world is generally connected with a high opinion of self. And we have to let everybody know how wonderful we are so they can think so too. And so there's behind this growth in admiration in the estimation of the world, there's always a high opinion of self behind it. In other words, there's this desire to be independent and autonomous from God, self-sufficient from God. This is the spirit that characterizes the Babylonian system. In fact, over in Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 7, in describing the nation of Babylon that would come in and judge Israel, God says they are dreaded and feared, their justice and authority originate with themselves. They are autonomous. They are self-determinative. They are self-sufficient. They are their own authority, and therefore everything derives from themselves. This is the heart of a Babylonian system. In Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 13, speaking of Israel again, Jesus, or God, says, "My people have committed two evils. They've forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, to hew for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns, that can hold no water." Notice, they hew for themselves. They were going to build a tower for themselves, to make a name for themselves. It's all self-serving. All false religion, whether it's pagan, whether it's perverted and corrupted Christianity, all false religion is self-worship. And it all extends back to Babel. And it has dominated all people in the past, and it's going to reach its peak under the reign of the beast. Notice, and we've seen this so much in the past, just think of the Roman Catholicism. It's all self-worship, works, self-salvation. All these things, all systems, they're false. And they've always been false. This includes all apostasies from true Christianity. And in the time of the rule of the beast, all of these false systems are going to be gathered together under the rule of the beast. They're going to be in allegiance to him. They're going to worship him in his image because it's in their own self-interest to do so. And if self is the ultimate object of worship, then whatever is in the self-interest, religion will have no problem capitulating to it. Their loyalty will be to the beast. Their devotion will be to him. They will place their trust in him and his system. After all, they say, who is like the beast? So there may be many different forms of this self-worship, but they all have one thing in common. They're all man-centered. They're all self-salvation. They make people their own saviors. And of course, never in the history of the world have we, in our lifetime, has there been so many false religions, cults. Just think of all the influence of the charismatic, the seeker, the emergent, liberal Christianity. There's too many to name, to mention. All these things calling themselves Christian. It used to be the primary false system that was out there was Roman Catholicism. And that's what the Reformers, the Puritans, others battled against. And then there was the Church of England, which tried to go back to Roman Catholicism and would persecute anybody who disagreed with them. But today we are inundated with false systems, and they're brought to us through television, radio, the internet, bookstores, celebrity Christians, everything promoting and advancing this false system of self-worship. In fact, the bulk of Christians today hold to a form of godliness but deny its power. It's a form of Christianity that accommodates the world, accommodates all opinions. The way is broad, the way is easy, not narrow. No self-denial required. The thinking that's dominated by the spirit of the world is what dominates the thinking of the vast majority of professing Christians. We just want vague, abstract, light, uplifting teaching with little or no doctrine, just a pep talk. Self-affirming. You see, the weight of the doctrine that's taught, the depth, the seriousness of the doctrine that is held to and taught and proclaimed reveals what spirit the heart and mind that is teaching are under, whether it's dominion of the world, the harlot system, or Christ. Now, in the Old Testament, immorality was equated with idolatry, which was love and devotion to the creature over the Creator. And the harlot is the epitome of spiritual adultery. Harlotry is the epitome of spiritual adultery. All false religion, again, whether it's pagan, whether it's scientific, whether it's cults, whether it's integration of humanistic thinking with the Bible, all false forms of Christianity, all of these things are forms of spiritual adultery. And this harlotry represents, this harlot represents all false religions of all time. All that's opposed to the true knowledge of God, the true love for God, and His Word and living a life that's pleasing to Him. John tells us that this harlot sits on many waters. What's that mean? Well, we don't have to wonder because verse 15 tells us what it is. And He said to me, "The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues." In other words, this harlot has a worldwide dominion. The domain of darkness is universal. It is no respecter of persons. The influence is universal because it's the natural condition of all people. It's the condition in which we are all born. We're born under the dominion and the domain of darkness. We're born self-centered, seeking our own righteousness. And this spiritual adultery is not limited to one strata of society, as verse 2 makes plain. It's with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of immorality. See, it's not limited to one level of society. It's not limited to one nation, to one culture, to one group of people. There's no such thing as a Christian nation. But this is speaking of all people in all times. All have interacted with and all participated in and with this harlot. Again, the accusation is repeated in chapter 18, verse 3. "For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality." It is financially lucrative to be connected with this false system. And because most are under her influence, they were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. In other words, this harlot obtains this level of influence because of her cooperation with the political domination of the beast. See, the result of compromise with political and economic powers leads to this sort of spiritual harlotry. When spiritual harlotry becomes commercially viable and financially lucrative, then it becomes very appealing to many, many people, especially worldly-minded people, self-centered people, people who worship themselves. And it's lucrative because it appeals to the fallen nature. It finds a ready market. And so, those who join with the harlot, who buy into this system, they're willing to sacrifice whatever spiritual principles are necessary to get in on this Babylonian system. Pragmatism, the spirit of compromise, not biblical truth, will dictate all their decisions, especially in an atmosphere and culture that's strongly anti-Christian, where we can water it down, tone it down, shave off the sharp edges of its doctrine, make it more appealing to self-centered people, actually turn Christianity into something that is all about self. This becomes very appealing, especially in an age and a time when people will not endure sound doctrine, when there's a hostility to sound doctrine. And it's because sound doctrine becomes detrimental to their own self-interests. So to preserve the self-interests, they compromise, pragmatism, join forces with worldly interests, and you wind up with an apostate Christianity that eagerly seeks and solicits an adulterous relationship with the world. It wants to make friends with the world, wants to accommodate the world, integrate with the world. And the allegiance to this false system is so strong that it intoxicates them. They're made drunk with the wine of immorality. And there's a lust and a desire for more of it. What gives validation to their self-centeredness, their self-importance, their self-gratification, to indulge the flesh in worldly desires? It intoxicates them to irrational thinking, to where to indulge the flesh in their fleshly desires, they will even go to the extremes of being so irrational that they say there's no difference between a man and a woman. Or if you feel like a man, you're a man. If you feel like a woman, you're a woman. Doesn't matter what your gender really is. That's how far they're willing to go into this Babylonian. That's how intoxicated they become with this immorality. It intoxicates the irrational thinking. It inhibits the judgment. Jeremiah, over in Jeremiah 51, verse 7, speaking of this irrationality. Babylon has been a golden cup in the hand of the Lord, intoxicating all the earth. The nations have drunk of her wine. Therefore, the nations are going mad. See, it's all spiritual. It's all spiritual. Well, in verse 3, John is given a different perspective now, a different vantage point from which to view this harlot. He carried me away in the spirit, that is, one of these seven angels that had the seven bowls, carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns. Now this again is an allusion to Isaiah chapter 21, verses 1 and verses 9. I'll just read those real quickly. The oracle concerning the wilderness of the sea. So here it's speaking of this wilderness, this wasteland that comes about because of this Babylonian system. And then in verse 9, now behold, here comes a troop of riders, horsemen in pairs. And one answered and said, fallen, fallen is Babylon, and all the images of her gods are shattered to the ground. You see, the images that people used to make in terms of idolatry, every image, every idol is simply an imagination of the mind of what they think God is like, the way they want him to be, rather than what he truly is. One that serves and is in their self-interest. And all of those are going to be done away with. So John is taken away to this wilderness, this spiritual wilderness, this spiritual wasteland. And he sees this woman sitting on a scarlet beast. In other words, depicting her influence over earthly powers, their way of thinking, their reasoning. It's all futile, it's all vain, it's darkened in their understanding because they've rejected the light, because they're willingly ignorant, because they're in some sort of system, false system, that worships self rather than the true God, that is more concerned with self-interest than the interests of God. Now this beast that's mentioned here is the same one described in chapter 13, verse 1, the beast that was coming up out of the sea. This is the Antichrist, the satanically inspired and satanically empowered world leader. And this harlot exercises influence over him, but yet she's dependent upon him. And this is true for all false religion, isn't it? False religion is dependent upon earthly powers to keep it going, to allow it to propagate, to endorse it, to promote it, or to at least allow it to exist. And so, but yet, this false will also exercise the influence over these powers just in the way they're thinking, in their futile, man-centered, ungodly way of thinking. And we see that this scarlet beast is full of blasphemous names. You see, false Christianity, false systems of religion, has no problem with forging an alliance with the world, even when that political power is anti-God, is actually blasphemous to God. It's when it sets itself up and places itself in a position of authority over God, when it comes to actually judge God's law rather than live by God's law. And so false Christianity has no problem with forging an alliance with the world, with other false religions, with ungodly political powers, if it serves their own self-interests. They'll misrepresent God, Jesus, the Holy Spirit, faith, Christianity. That's not a problem, as long as it serves their self-interest. As long as we can profit from it. And this beast also is described as having 7 heads and 10 horns. As we will see later in this description, that these 7 heads are the 7 consecutive world powers that have essentially dominated and corrupted Israel. It was Egypt. Egypt worshipped the gods of the Egyptians, right? Even carried their gods with them into the wilderness. They were completely corrupted by this false system of religion. Then there was Assyria, then there were the Babylonians, then there were the Medes and Persians, and the Greeks and the Romans, and finally there'll be the kingdom of the beast. And all of these will have false systems of religion that were aspects of it, were integrated with, and were became syncretistic with. And the 10 horns, as we'll see, are 10 nations that are contemporaneous with the beast's kingdom. And this is described in Daniel chapter 2, verse 40 through 45, as Daniel is interpreting the dream or the vision of Nebuchadnezzar, the statue. And you have the feet of iron mixed with clay and the 10 toes. And so these 10 horns are 10 nations that are contemporaneous with the beast's kingdom. Well, this relationship that the harlot has with the beast has existed throughout human history. The relationship of false religion with political power has existed throughout history. Over in Ezekiel, we see this described in God's accusations against Ezekiel and their forsaking the true God. In Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 26, he says, "You also played the harlot with the Egyptians, your lustful neighbors, and multiplied your harlotry to make me angry." And then again, verse 28, "Moreover, you played the harlot with the Assyrians because you were not satisfied. You played the harlot with them and still were not satisfied." In verse 29, "You also multiplied your harlotry with the land of merchants, Chaldea, that is Babylon." And that's as far as Ezekiel goes, because that's where Israel is at this particular time, under Babylonian captivity. There's still the Medes, the Greeks, the Romans, all these that had an influence, and a corrupting influence, on the worship of the one true God. And so there's always been this relationship between the harlot and the beast throughout human history. It's a false religion that gives spiritual cohesion to a political system. We see this. Remember when I first read the Book of Concord, which is kind of the Lutheran book of theology and doctrine. At the very outset of the book, the very purpose that the King of Germany had the book written was so he could have a united religious front at home before he went to war with Turkey, with the Turks. And so there's this desire to have a spiritual cohesion in a nation, and that is a spiritual cohesion and alliance to a political system. We just think in Japan, the spiritual cohesion is Shintoism. In the Middle East, it's Islam. In India, it's Hinduism. In China, Buddhism. Roman Catholicism has been the spiritual cohesion through many nations of the world. In America, Europe, we have a cultural Christianity. You're a Christian just because you were born here. And in some, it's a nationalism. But whatever it is, there's some sort of false spiritual system that partners with the political system to provide a spiritual cohesion to a political system. And this is what this great harlot has been throughout history. The relationship between the harlot and the beast. Here it comes to its culmination at the end time. Then there's a description of the woman's clothing, her attire. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup. In other words, she's got everything to attract a mind set on this world. She has the appearance of honor, prestige, wealth, success, ease, prosperity. That she was adorned, literally that word adorned is gilded, and it's in the perfect tense, indicating an action that occurred in the past, with the results continuing to the present. And it's in the passive voice. So she was gilded by someone or something else. Who? Well, her followers. Just think of the riches that the Roman Catholic Church has been adorned with by its followers. Just think of the word of faith preachers, the cult leaders, many in the charismatic movement. And then there's this ostentatious, flamboyant flaunting of the emblems of their worldly success, their self-glorification and self-indulgence. In other words, this system entices by fleshly desires. After all, what is 18, chapter 18, verse 7? To the degree that she, that is this harlot, glorified herself and lived sensuously. So that's what all this ostentatious clothing, it's a self-glorification, a self-indulgence. It's this producing this willingness to compromise for what the harlot offers. She has this gold cup. Looks good on the outside, but it's full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality. It's a Christianity without the cross, a Christianity without self-denial. It's your best life now. It's self-fulfillment on a broad, easy way to heaven. Her cup is full of abominations. That is, that which is utterly abhorrent and detestable to God. Now, why would anyone be attracted to an abomination? Why would anybody be attracted to what is utterly abhorrent and detestable to God? Well, I think we have a pretty good clue from what Jesus said over in Luke chapter 16, verse 15, concerning the Pharisees. who are lovers of money. He said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable," same word, "an abomination in the sight of God." So why would people go for an abomination? Well, it's offered in a gold cup by someone that has all the trappings of success and of honor. Everything that the world highly esteems. The word "highly esteemed" there in Luke 16:50 means to place a high value on it. Remember what Isaiah said of Jesus in his prophecy of the suffering servant, Isaiah 53:3, "He was despised and we did not esteem him." Placed no value on Jesus Christ. But yet, fallen man and fallen world systems and false religious systems place a high value on what is actually an abomination to God. And that's why the world would be sucked into this sort of false spirituality, false systems of religion, because it offers things that are highly valued by the natural man. And so this gold cup is full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality. Literally, it's even of the unclean things of her immorality. In other words, it defines her abominations. They're the unclean things of her immorality. They all belong to idolatry. And of course, the ultimate idols are self and the world. Everything that belongs to unholy living, to the flesh, fleshly enticements, pride, all the falsehood, false gospels, false Jesuses, turning sin into a virtue, calling evil good and good evil, all of these things are part of the system that are what this gold cup is full of. But yet it's so attractive to the world. It has made the nations drunk, leaders drunk, people throughout history drunk. It's where they forsake the true God for the false. And then the woman's identity is revealed. Upon her forehead a name was written, a mystery. For the first time, her true character and identity is revealed. If you remember, in the Bible, a mystery is something that is previously unrevealed. May have been alluded to, but not actually revealed. And so for the first time, her true character and identity is revealed. She's Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and of the abominations of the earth. This is the identity of this harlot. She's not just a harlot, she's the mother of harlots. All harlotry springs from her. And she's Babylon the Great, the mother of all false systems of religion, all apostasy, all atheism, all have as their source, ultimately, self-worship. Idolatry of self. Let us make a name for ourselves. It's the love of the creature over the Creator. This system, this Babylon the Great, mother of harlot, abominations of the earth, all that is an abomination to God. Its goal is to remove the heart of people from God to the gratification of self and worldly desires, to be a slave to sin, self, and the world. And all of this is inflamed by a close connection with and preoccupation with life in this world. Self-salvation is self-worship. We are inundated with forms of self-salvation today. Not just the false religions, the idolatries, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, whatever. But even Arminianism is self-salvation. You make the choice, God makes the change. See, I made the choice, so that's self-salvation. Self-salvation is self-worship. It is to make people their own savior. And any religion that exalts self is from the system of the harlot. Any system of religion that appeals and panders to the flesh, that flatters self, that tickles the ears, that entices by the world and flesh, is the harlot system. And it has been going on since Babel. And then verse 6, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of saints and with the blood of the witness of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered greatly. Listen, the harlot hates having her system exposed for what it is. This is why the Jews sought to trick Jesus, trap Jesus, watch his every move, twist his words. Because he exposed them for what they were. He exposed their false system of religion for what it was. He exposed their self-righteousness from what it was, which is what they worshiped. And so this harlot will persecute all who would expose them and expose it with the truth. Or they'll turn away their ears from the truth and turn aside the myth. See, darkness cannot stand the light. And it will not come to the light. It shuns the light. Lest it be exposed. As what? As part of the system. False. Untrue. Darkness, not light. Part of the kingdom of darkness in which this woman is in illusion. This is what infuriates false religion. This is why she's hostile. And this is why her hostile anti-Christian nature may look nice on the outside, talk sweet, be sweet, entice with all sorts of fleshly enticements, be very tolerant of other views. But her hostility and her anti-Christian nature is revealed by how she responds to truth and to her treatment of those who proclaim it. And in this period of time, at the end of the tribulation period, this rule of the beast is going to create and permit an environment in which the harlot, this false system of religion, can murder the true saints and witnesses with impunity. You've seen it before, haven't we? Persecutions under Roman Catholicism. The Inquisition. State government, state-sponsored persecution. They can't stand, false systems of religion can't stand to be revealed for what they are. So, they persecute those that reveal it. And says she's drunk with the blood of the saints and the witnesses. See, self will do anything to preserve its own self-interest. Even murder. Again, just think of Roman Catholicism. See, most people, rather than murder, most people who are in the system of the harlot and under this dominion, they don't let go to the extent of murder. Most of them just gather together to encourage each other in their own self-worship and affirm their own self-salvation. This is why we need a new self, why we need a new nature. Because the old one is under the dominion of darkness. It's under the domain of darkness. It's under the dominion of these false systems. And this is what Jesus came to purchase. This is what Jesus came to create, is a new person. Created in the image of the one who created them. To redeem a people for his own possession, for a kingdom that's not of this world, and to set the hearts and minds of his on things above where Christ is, and take them off from self and this world. That they should seek first his kingdom, his righteousness, and not be concerned with what you're going to eat and what you're going to drink. Because that's all part of this world. That's what the Gentiles, the unbelievers, all seek after. Therefore, they get caught up in a system that promises them all these things. Well, it says, when John saw her, when I saw her, I wondered greatly. Literally, it's, I marveled a great marvel. It's describing just complete and utter astonishment on the part of John by what he's seen. Why is he astonished? Well, we're not told. It's not stated. But we can be assured it's not in admiration. He's not awestruck with her purple and scarlet and gold and precious stones and pearls and her gold cup. He's not in awe of those. He's not marveling the same way as those in chapter 13, verse 3, were amazed and marveled over the beast and followed him. John is not about to compromise the truth, to be seduced by this false system like so many others have been, and like most have been today. Again, the question of Jesus still stands. What does it profit a man to gain the world and lose his soul? What does it profit to be involved in a false system of religion, thinking that false system is going to save you, but at the end here, depart from me, I never knew you? It's to our own self-interest that we are in the true faith and not a false counterfeit faith. In the kingdom of light rather than the domain of darkness. Well, you have any comments or questions?